Coming up today on the Lead to Succeed podcast.
The only way that people really learn is by watching and by doing. And if we have people at the top who don't embrace a servant mindset, then it's very unlikely that it'll trickle down.
Do you want to learn the tricks the top leaders use to get the most out of themselves and their teams? Well, Naftali Hoff is here to help. Lead to Succeed picks the brains of top leaders to learn about their challenges, insights, and best practices. Here's Naftali. Hello, Lead to Succeed Nation. Naftali Hoff here with you. Our interesting fact for today is, on average, we shower for 11 minutes a day. Not sure if I bring that average up or down. Today, we have the pleasure of speaking to Dr. Christopher Ewing. Chris is a leader of operations, professor, Lean Six Sigma Black Belt, and an executive trainer. He served in the United States Air Force in multiple leadership roles while on active duty. After transitioning from the military, he now works in healthcare leadership. And, oh, by the way, Chris, aka Dr. Ewing, was a member of my dissertation committee and played a key role in ensuring that I completed my doctorate. Chris, thanks so much for coming on the show. It's so great to have you.
Thank you for having me.
So I wanted to jump in. You have so much here. You know, when I read these bios, I sometimes get a little overwhelmed and feel kind of small compared to some of my guests. And the fact that you spent time in the Air Force and accomplished so much and now have moved into some of the training work, there's so much to unpack here. But the one thing that, in all honesty, I know the least about, at least at this moment, is Lean Six Sigma Black Belt. So tell us, what is it and how does it help you do your work?
Yeah, absolutely. So Lean Six Sigma is a process improvement methodology that's built off of statistical acumen. So Lean, as a standalone, is a great way for a lot of processes to become adaptable and more efficient. When you couple that with the Six Sigma work, Sigma is a statistical methodology whereby you decrease variation in processes. So they work really well together, and there are certain levels you can achieve. The most common are green and black, but there is a yellow belt certification. Once you get to the black belt certification, you're certified to essentially lead, analyze, and improve processes across an organization. The only level above that that I'm aware of is a master black belt, where you're essentially still a black belt, but you're leading other black belts in their projects across an organization.
So what would be an example of when somebody would use these skills?
So they're very common in fields like supply chain, and actually healthcare is training up a lot of black belts. It actually started in the manufacturing environment. The Toyota production system was the first place that really used Lean and encouraged Six Sigma. So if you have a manufacturing process, you're looking to decrease deviations from the process, obviously. So we go from X number of defects per million to hopefully a substantial improvement over that.
Got it. So really Lean and Six Sigma are two separate entities that come together. Is that the concept?
Essentially, yes. The certification is offered through various institutes. We've been lucky enough to partner in my healthcare organization with Huron Global, which is one of the organizations that does certifications for Lean and Six Sigma.
Got it. Okay. So now that I got a little more clarity there, I wanted to jump into the military side if I could. Tell me a little bit. I'm always fascinated, and I think many people are, about the military. It's somewhat of an enigma for many people. There are a lot of pieces that we understand, but we recognize that there's a lot behind the scenes. And specifically as it relates to leadership and the work that you're doing today, what did the military teach you about leadership, and how are you applying it in your work?
So I had a really interesting and varied career while I was in the military. I was in a really small officer-heavy career field. I commissioned out of ROTC into the nuclear career field, so I did space and ICBM operations. As an ICBM operator, we did a lot of immediate troubleshooting and operational leadership style. I had the opportunity to move on from there to do instruction, which really kind of broadened my ideas about leadership, because we were able to teach classes based on professional military development. And a lot of the professional military development courses focus on leadership, as you can imagine.
Sure.
Change management, process management, that sort of thing, were also extremely common topics. In most career fields, in the Air Force and the military in general, you move every 3 to 4 years at a minimum. I think I was averaging about a year and a half job to job.
Mm-hmm.
So the military teaches a lot about leadership. They endorse, especially the Air Force endorses, the full range leadership model, which basically has everything from command and control to charismatic leadership to more servant style leadership. And the expectation is that based on the situation, so kind of like situational leadership, you pull your style out of that tool bag.
Sure. So let me ask you this, because one of the things you hear more and more about in the workplace is the idea of leading up. You know, the idea where you want to give not only leaders great feedback, but also the opportunity for the workers, especially, I would say, the younger workers in our workforce, the opportunity to feel like they're making an impact, sharing their thoughts, that type of thing. What type of opportunity, if any, exists within the military for people who want to lead up, who are not necessarily the highest ranked, but they see things and they have opportunities to share insights that may ultimately be useful for the chain of command?
Sure. And leading up is a crucial skill that they teach young officers and junior enlisted people. So our junior enlisted consists of three basic hierarchies. There's the most junior enlisted, then there's the staff sergeant level, and then there's the senior enlisted. So those middle enlisted people are the workhorse of the Air Force, if you will. They have to lead up in order to get their ideas heard, because they're the ones who do all of the real work and have the frontline perspective of the processes. A lot of them are in their first leadership positions, much like the junior officers that I, like the position that I held. So we go through our professional military education. We're mentored by more senior people typically. Mentorship is a huge thing in the Air Force because it corresponds with on-the-job training or OJT. So in order to manage up, we're taught basic tactics, techniques, and procedures to politically, that is, in a way that won't offend the people above us, to give suggestions to our commanders. So, for instance, if you have an idea for a process that will increase the safety of travel to and from a missile operations site, you're taught how to present that in a quick, decisive, and action-oriented way. So instead of presenting someone with a problem, you present someone with a problem and a solution.
Mm. You know, I really love that idea. The last words you just said about being taught how to present your information, because not only does that acknowledge that the military is open to the idea of leading up, but it gives everybody a baseline by which, or a process by which to do that. And I think oftentimes one of the challenges people have in the workplace is, I have an idea, but I don't really know how to share it and to do so in a way where it will be positively accepted and supported. And here you're saying basically we value it, and not only do we value it, we're going to give you a way by which to do it. So that I think is great.
It's something that I've learned to apply in my civilian career, and that I found a surprising amount of resistance to in general, is the idea that, because I think that civilians often are a little bit more ego invested in their position, because they aren't used to the transition every 3 to 4 years into a new role. Whereas we, as Air Force people, understood that we would hold our position essentially as a steward, so that we would be ready to turn it over better than where we assumed the position in the first place.
So that's interesting. Would you suggest, as a common practice within the corporate or civilian workplace, that people should not necessarily view themselves as stewards, but there should be some transition just for the purpose of not only helping people learn new skills, but also keeping them more hungry, more open, you know, create the lines of feedback that perhaps don't exist otherwise?
I would. I'm not sure about actually transitioning, but I would encourage a stewardship mindset, using someone's time, talent, and treasure in order to make the position, make the organization better. Additionally, part of that stewardship is succession planning, having a continuity plan in place. That's the sort of thing that a lot of organizations don't necessarily do well.
Interesting. So just for my own clarification, when you talk about a stewardship mindset, what does that primarily entail?
So when I talk about time, talent, and treasure, everyone has their own unique abilities, their own place that they come from, their own leadership attributes, if you will. and being able to use those properly. And by properly, I mean authentically and with integrity, being able to plan for the next person, for the next leader to come into your role, to make sure that the people below you are exercising stewardship in return. It's much like the reciprocal relationship between a servant and those led.
And who would you say is most responsible for creating that stewardship mindset?
That has to be top down. If your leadership doesn't embrace that sort of mentality, that leadership style, then it probably won't get traction in an organization.
I don't want to harp on it too much, but I'm finding this fascinating. And I wanted to ask you, is it possible then, or would it be necessary then, for the leader to also demonstrate a stewardship mindset?
Absolutely. As you know, the way that people learn is through modeling. And that's not just a psychological perspective or psychobabble. We've had everyone from presidents to coaches to anyone can tell you that the only way that people really learn is by watching and by doing. And if we have people at the top who don't embrace a servant mindset, then it's very unlikely that it'll trickle down. We like to see things like groundswells of support for certain ideas, but within the rigid hierarchy of a company, it's less likely.
Mm. Let's move a little bit here, but still within the framework of leadership. And I wanted to ask you another question, because I'm sure you're familiar, perhaps you've observed it firsthand, but certainly familiar with the research about the turnover in leadership and how many CEOs and other chief executives are not really lasting so long in their current positions. And I wanted to get your take on it. What do you think is the main reason that so many people are failing at leadership, and what can we do about it?
You know, I've read a lot of books on this topic, and one of the things that stood out to me was that it's not just the CEOs that are experiencing high turnover. I think that CEOs in particular are a unique group because they lead the entire organization. Their exodus could have anything to do with their ethical issues that they've experienced, but it could also be as simple as they're older and they're retiring, or the company has experienced a specific downturn in a product line, and they decided that it was a good time to exit. I think my main problem is that the vast majority of leaders and managers in any company are its middle managers. And so many of those middle managers are leaving their positions because, in my opinion, and based on some extant research, people leave their positions based on having a poor experience with their boss. Mm. People quit bosses, not jobs.
Mm-hmm. So if a person has failed, for whatever the reason, and apparently from your definition, you don't see it necessarily so much, correct me if I'm wrong here, about the failure of the middle manager as much as the failure of his or her manager. But to the degree that it is the, for lack of a better term, the fault or the cause of this middle manager or anyone who's being asked to step out, what could someone like that do to get it right the next time?
You know, recovering from our failures is something that we all have to work on. I think it was President Lincoln who said that you need to stand up, get back up after each of your failures. And he was a master at that. He and Walt Disney and several other extremely influential and successful individuals who experienced good, hard failures. The thing to do is really realize that mistakes happen, that everyone makes mistakes, and that it's important to learn the lessons from that, to be able to be humble enough and approachable enough to accept any of the criticism that comes your way, any of the potentially negative feedback, and incorporate that into your next practice.
Sure. And do you think most people could do that on their own, or do you think that they need outside eyes in order to sort of show them specifically where the issues were?
It's been my experience that very few people can operate in a vacuum. It's one of the reasons that institutions like social psychology exists, is to provide people with the opportunity to grow and learn and collaborate. I'm not sure that any single person could have the internal resources necessary to gain the perspective to then go and measure what they had done and learn to improve from it. It's not impossible. It is something that has been done, but just like Leon Vygotsky, I know I'm butchering that poor man's name, but the zone of proximal development, the idea of mentorship, of pushing someone to the next level based on where they already are, is an extremely important event.
Yeah, it's interesting because I just recently published a book called Becoming the New Boss. And the book, to a large degree, when I talk about it, I share that it's the kind of resource I wish I had when I was getting started. But to me, there was a very therapeutic element in writing it because it gave me the opportunity to reflect much more clearly, I think, in retrospect, about the things that I did well and the things, unfortunately, many things, you know, to a large degree, the many things that I didn't do so well and where I saw some issues and trying to recount the experience and the feedback that I got and where all of that came from. So to me, it's a really critical thing for leaders to be able to engage in regular introspection. And especially when things go wrong like that, the normal reaction for many people is to point fingers, to blame somebody else, and to sort of talk about circumstance or somebody who had an axe to grind, whatever that might look like. It's much more convenient to do it that way. But the reality is, if we're not prepared to look inside deeply and to see where are the opportunities for growth, the likelihood of repeating those same mistakes the next time, if you even get another opportunity, is much higher. And so to me, it's really, really critical, whether it's getting a coach or finding some other way by which to engage in that process, to own the experience, to glean all the good. And I'm sure each person, no matter how difficult their experience is, did a lot of great things. But how do they also make an honest assessment of who they are and where they need to go so that they can enjoy sustained success the next time?
It's true. And like you said, the assessment is really key. You have to have the wherewithal, the training, if you will, or at least the education to understand how to actually incorporate that into your daily practice. How do you gain that perspective? How do you critically reflect?
Yeah, it is a process and it takes time and a lot of discipline. So tell me, Chris, who was one person or the one person that helped you most to get you to where you are today? And what specifically did they do to support you?
It's interesting you asked that question. As I've been thinking about it over the last day or two, there have been a lot of people that have gotten me to where I am. I'd say that the person that has helped me the most is my MBTI opposite, my best friend, Jamiel Vidal. He's also a PhD. He runs a consulting company, and he was also an Air Force veteran. I remember the lessons that he taught me while we were in our first assignment, in our first operational assignment, about becoming a servant, having a good work ethic, and always looking on the bright side, even if there wasn't really a bright side. He's a true force, a true optimistic force. And just the opportunity to work with people who are willing to work for you and with you and promote you is it's a rare opportunity to find someone like that.
So tell me what you meant when you said your MBTI opposite. I mean, I get the idea, but what specifically about that helped bring out the best in you?
So I've often done MBTI training. And for those of you who are not aware, it's Myers-Briggs type indicator. So there are 16 various combinations that are possible with the MBTI. And you'll see those in a rough grid. I happen to be wavering indecisively between two of them now, the ISTJ and INTJ. And my friend is extremely extroverted and he feels very deeply about people. And he's very perceptive and he thinks about future events, whereas I'm very process oriented and I think about realities and facts and figures. I'm also extremely introverted. If I have to go to work, I prep myself beforehand to be able to interact with people on the most positive and extroverted type of way. It doesn't have to be loud, but it does have to be authentic. And I think that's something that a lot of introverts struggle with.
Yes.
But I did learn from him how to do that. And a lot of it just has to do with a projection, but an authentic projection, some bringing out truly who you are, even though it might be psychologically draining.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. It's interesting because I'm also an introvert and I find there's a lot of misconception out there about what an introvert is and how it differs from an extrovert. And oftentimes people think of it as how loud a person is, how sociable. But in reality, it's more about, like you indicated, about your source of energy. And sometimes for people who are introverted, going into a crowded space can be very draining. So it's interesting to hear about how you prep. And I talk to my guests and I ask them about their morning rituals and I ask them about their preparatory practices. And they talk about exercise and meditation or various other things that they deal with. It's interesting to hear your perspective in terms of psyching yourself up to be able to go out into a social space and to feel comfortable. Is there anything in particular for the introverts listening? And frankly, I think for the extroverts who are just curious about this topic, is there anything in particular that you recommend for other introverts that they could use in order to feel most comfortable in a social space?
I think honestly, just divesting yourself of expectation is very important. If you go in understanding how you want other people to perceive you, as opposed to thinking about how other people will or have perceived you in the past, just banish any expectations that you have and understand that you define how you're seen, and that even though perception is important, perception has to be authentic and comes from within. So you'll be seen as who you are as long as you're focusing on projecting that authentic personality. And a lot of it is about projection, regardless of how draining it is.
Sure. That's a beautiful way to end this segment. Thank you, Chris. I'm sort of thinking about the idea of divesting from expectation. And, you know, we're also concerned about how we're going to come across. And I think that people with any type of, I don't want to call it a hang up, but anyone who's got this concern about their physical appearance, some of their mannerisms, the way that they come across socially, we tend to dwell on those. And as a result, they hold us back and they don't allow us to really, you know, maintain our greatest energy and our maximum potential and getting the most out of a situation. But your strategy is really spot on, because if you can find a way to put that little gremlin off to the side, just be who you are and let it all flow, you'd be surprised how many people would just accept you, and not only accept you, but embrace you for who you are and not for being something different. So to me, that's a great, very liberating thought. And I thank you for that.
Absolutely.
So now we're going to shift into our rapid fire. Some quick questions, a little bit more light, but I think everybody will enjoy hearing from you on these. If you could master one form of martial arts, since we talked about the Six Sigma black belt earlier, which would it be?
I would choose jiu-jitsu. It's a form that encourages people to be close to each other and use leverage.
Beautiful. Something that only a few people know about you.
I caught a 186-pound halibut when I lived in Alaska, and I weighed only 105 pounds myself at the time.
Wow. I think we're going to have to schedule another call to hear more about that. That's exciting. How do you like your steak?
Rare. Blue rare.
Okay, great. And finally, the best time to exercise?
I like to exercise at night because there are fewer people in my gym.
That's interesting, because I go first thing in the morning. To me, it sort of sets my day. And I'm afraid that if I exercise at night, it's going to keep me up. But I guess you don't have that issue.
Not at all.
Okay. So how could folks get in touch with you and learn more about your work, Chris?
So if you reach out to me at chris@perficitus.com, so my company is called Perficitus Consulting Group.
Could you spell that for us?
Absolutely. It's Perficitis. It's a Latin word that means to improve or to achieve.
Okay. So before we go, one last final life lesson. It could be from the military, anywhere else from your experience.
Absolutely. The key to leadership, in my opinion, is becoming the kind of person that others will want to follow.
Beautiful. Said succinctly, but very powerfully. Chris, thank you so much again for joining me on the Lead to Succeed podcast. It's been a pleasure having you on today. We've learned so much from you. I'm looking forward to continuing our conversation.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Today's leadership quote is from David Joseph Schwartz. Think little goals and expect little achievements. Think big goals and win big success. Thanks so much for listening to this episode and for investing in yourself so that you could lead to succeed. Before you go, don't forget to head over to my website, impactfulcoaching.com, where you could sign up for our blog, download a free leadership ebook, and so much more. Thanks again, and have a great day.